just landed on the ice runway at McMurdo Station in Antarctica and spent 5 hours on a C-17, flying to the pole from New Zealand, from Christchurch, New Zealand. I'm Andrea Poli, you're listening to Giant Ear, and this is Sonic Antarctica, a series of recordings that were done this season in Antarctica by myself and a number of different residents there. I'm going to play for you next a 5-minute piece related to the transportation around Antarctica. We have a number of different helicopters and other types of transportation, and that kind of dominates the soundscape there. So this next piece is a mix including communication sounds and transportation sounds.
Thank you.
What was it?
Ask him what the temperature was last night. What temperature is now?
What the temperature is.
Over.
The temperature here right now is about
minus 31 degrees. Fuck you.
I need to go, there's a little more. And here we are, listening to Giant Ear, and this is Sonic Antarctica, a series of recordings that were done in Antarctica this season by a number of different people, and by myself, and I'm Andrea Poli. And the next piece we're going to listen to is a mix of communication sounds at a place called MacOps. Most of my time was spent at McMurdo Station, which is on Ross Island, just south of Christchurch, New Zealand. And Tia Kramer is an artist who spent several seasons down in Antarctica. And her job there, among other things, is working in what's called MacOps, the operations or the communication center. So at 2 in the morning, while she was working the night shift, she recorded this piece on HF radio.
Thank you.
This is Giant Ear, Sonic Antarctica, and that was just a piece by Tia Kramer, who is a resident of Antarctica for several past years, and she works in a place called Mac Ops, and that's the sound of Mac Ops at 2 in the morning, the HF radio sound. The next section I'm going to play for you is what it's like at McMurdo Station.
Hey, Andrea.
Yes.
Can we give a shout Johnny. Out? Can we give a shout out to the Igloo Posse?
Before
the next piece.
We're crowded down in the igloo here today. We've got
roll it up.
We've got Chili Ned.
You're gonna give everyone. You should give everyone like Antarctic nicknames. So you got Chili Ned.
Snowflake Joe.
Snowflake Joe. Okay.
Iceman Chuck.
Iceman Chuck, yeah. And jumping because my ass is cold. Sorry.
And
who are you? What's your nickname?
I don't know.
Come on.
Green Shock.
Don't make us do it because...
Green
it could
Shock.
What?
What did you say Green Shock was like?
Oh, Green Shock.
Green Shock, yeah.
Green Shock,
yeah, I'm in Green Shock still. Yeah. Yeah. But 6 months later.
Oh my God, leaves.
So, one thing that I did while I was down there is I did a few workshops in sound recording and field recording, and I led a sound walk, and there were a number of really great recordings that came out of that from the people who went on the sound walk and who were interested in sound. These next two pieces, they're very short, are by an architect named Julie Catch. And she recorded really a sense of what McMurdo Station and some of the buildings sound like. They're very subtle, quiet recordings.
Thank you.
was two pieces by Julie Catch. You're listening to Giant Ear, Sonic Antarctica. Julie was a resident of McMurdo Station over the this last season doing architecture work. The next two pieces also give you a sense of life in McMurdo Station, and they're by Tia Kramer. We heard a piece by Tia Kramer earlier, the HF Radio. So this is a kiosk piece and Whistling Flags and Walking.
Is it windy?
Right now?
Not so much.
15 miles an hour.
Is it good for you?
That's great.
And tomorrow. And you'll go to get there.
Yep, tomorrow, cycle. All right. That was two pieces by Tia Kramer, a resident of Antarctica this season, and giving you a sense of what the Antarctic experience is like on base, on McMurdo Station. This next piece is a 7-minute piece by Anne Alvera, and Anne Alvera is pretty amazing. I met her when she was running a tour of what was called Pressure Ridge, an area where icebergs were kind of coming up out of the ice shelf. And it turns out she was one of four women who skied from the shore of Antarctica, from the Antarctic coast to the South Pole. Just an amazing person. And she literally does a sound walk a la Hildegard Westerkamp of McMurdo Station. So here is Ann Del Vera. This is a mono piece, one tone.
Sound. that's smiled at me, and there's not much wind. I can see Hut Point Peninsula with the fences crossed and the Discovery Hut. Patricia, what do you think is the most interesting sound you've encountered so far on your walk? I think that water that we just heard going through the Bond Stream was kind of mysterious. I couldn't tell where it was coming from or where it was going or if it was inside or outside. So that's sort of puzzling to me so far. Okay, cool. Thanks. You know, when we're walking across some very melted snow that melts, more like crunchy remnants of ice. Just walked over a bridge, a wooden bridge over the Bond Stream, down by the sea ice transition.
So, a model is only a caricature of, or a cartoon of the reality, and it will never match reality, and it actually wouldn't make sense to match reality. Then we don't need a model, then we can as well study it in reality, and we're even better off. And sometimes that's actually a pitfall. People build too complex models and then have to struggle with the same difficulties they would in reality, and the model is certainly less worse than in reality, so they would better do field work. But you have to see, we need models when we wanted to see what future impacts could do to our environment. And for those reasons, I believe we need the models despite all these deficiencies. However, it's not that bad. Even a cartoon usually has some truth to it. And even if it's distorting certain aspects or exaggerating certain ones and neglecting others, it is still only a good cartoon, you would say, if it matches some reality, if it resonates a string in you when you look at it. And I think that's exactly the same we have to do in science. We have to build models which have a relationship to reality which captures the crucial properties you're interested in a given context. This means if you use a model in climate change, it has to have different properties as if you use a model, let's say, to study what nutrients do and how you could fertilize forests or how you could get more out of plantations and so on. And that's actually, in fact, also the case. We have different models depending on what the purpose is for which we use. And it's the same. If you want to ridicule someone with a cartoon, you draw it differently than if you want to make a joke, or if you want to emphasize the pleasantness of a person or whatever on which you do the cartoon. So you can imagine that in a similar way. And this means it's not just an art, or it's not just a bitterly. We also test our models in particular to perform well in a changing climate, and that's why we use these models not only in the presence to correctly reproduce or mimic what we find today. We also, where we don't have that much climate change yet, we use those models in particularly also during past climate changes, where we had big climate changes of a similar magnitude as we expect in for the course of this century. Mm-hmm. And that is, for instance, at the end of the last ice age. We have data from those times. We've done such studies where we have from pollen data, from trees, we know what kind of species we had shortly afterwards the ice melted, and then when it got warmer and warmer and so on. And exactly the same thing we're trying to do with the model, to reproduce and simulate, how we call it, the change in the vegetation at that time. And if we match what we found in the pollen records well, then we say we have done a useful test for our model, and we are ready to use it to make projections into the future.
You're listening to Giant E, Sonic Antarctica. That was a piece by Anne Del Vera, A Sound Walk Around McMurdo Station, followed by an excerpt from an interview with Andreas Fischlein, who's one of the IPCC scientists who was a recipient of the 2007 Nobel Prize with Al Gore this year. The next piece I'm going to play is a piece that I recorded on Taylor Glacier in the Dry Valleys. And this was a really interesting experience. The glaciers in the summer are melting quite a bit, and when you have this amount of ice melting, you get some really strange shapes that are formed from the ice, and these shapes, some of these shapes are actually the shapes of musical instruments. So you'll hear at the end of this piece a really unusual, almost an electronic kind of sound that was just coming out of the glacier itself. I'm going to mix this with some excerpts from an interview with Dr. Rick Astor, who's a seismologist who does a lot of listening to audifications of seismology data. So this is Walking on Taylor Glacier.
So this is, also one way, of course, for me to think about the science when I hear these sounds, because, we all have a spectrum analyzer in our heads, especially those of us who've played music for a while, and it's kind of fascinating to think about the analogous ways that nature makes sound and human beings make sound, musical instruments, because human beings have basically figured out all the natural ways of making sounds and embedded them in one musical instrument or another. And so when you hear a sound in nature, it usually has some analogy in the orchestra.
on a glacier. That was Walking on Taylor Glacier. You're listening to Giant Ear. I'm Andrea Poli, presenting Sonic Antarctica. The next piece I'd like to present for you is by a sound artist who actually wasn't in Antarctica this season. These are recordings that Douglas Quinn made in 2000. And Douglas Quinn does a lot of bioacoustics work. And he was kind enough to lend me these pieces that are emperor penguins, Adelaide penguins, and Weddell seals. And so it's three different sections, about 6 minutes. Thank you.
That was Douglas Quinn's recordings of emperor penguins, Adelaide penguins, and Weddell seals. And you heard these penguins, and it was pretty interesting. I went to Cape Royds, which is a place where there's about a few penguin colonies, a couple thousand Adelaide penguins. And I met Jean Pennycook there, and she is an educator who was working on studying the penguins. And she, one thing that she was doing was recording the penguin greetings. And apparently, what I learned from Jean Pennycook is that each penguin has a very distinct kind of voice or a distinct kind of greeting that its child can recognize. And the parent penguin can also recognize the child's voice. So she uses these three recordings in her classes with her students and asks them to see if they can recognize the differences between these three calls. So I'll just play these three calls. They're about 2 minutes total. Were Adelaide Penguin recordings by Jean Pennycook at Cape Royds. This next very short piece is a recording of the sound of skuas. Skuas are large seagull-like animals that live all in and around the Antarctic, and I recorded these skuas on Cape Royds and learned a little bit about their relationship to the penguins. They like to steal the penguin eggs. And this is what happens when you get too close to a skua nest. These next two recordings for Sonic Antarctica were recordings that I took during the launch of a couple different types of balloons. The first recording is a launch of an ozone balloon at the South Pole Station. The Edmondson Scott South Pole Station is operated by the U.S. and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration launches regular balloons to measure the thickness of the ozone hole. And so this first recording is the sound of the data coming back from the ozone balloon with, I believe, a little bit of commentary from Andy Clark, who is a NOAA researcher down there. The next recording that I'll just play immediately after is another type of balloon, and this is a balloon that's used for
different types of research into the cosmos, actually.
No.
Yes. Well, it could be launched on your birthday.
That'd be great.
If the weather was right. It's the balloon's about the size of a football field, actually, and it goes way up into the atmosphere and stays up there for several weeks. And so this is right when the balloon was being filled up. I hung out at the ice runway for about 10 hours to wait for the weather to be perfect for this balloon to get launched. So we'll first be at the South Pole, and then we'll head out to the large duration balloon launch.
The little radio song is transmitting this data, and then so it comes out on the radio. Then we just go out there
to a modem.
So we're just creating a sound that the computer can understand, and then this program just reads that and then converts it all into, you know, pressure, temperature as it's going up, and that pump temperature, and then the ozone is plotting right here. So that's our tropospheric ozone.
Section of the balloon here from the Rio to here is going to curve, and then I'll let it go and it'll stand up.
Uh-huh.
It'll be standing up above the drum.
So that's kind of the bottom section.
It's the top.
Oh, okay.
This is the top. And so it goes all the way down there, the balloon, all the way down to there.
In
this parachute, and it goes up and over the top for the payload. So what will happen is this will get filled and it'll stand up.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll take about 45 minutes to an hour to fill completely.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they'll do is see that lever just by Reed's hand, that lever with the cord on it?
Yep.
They'll pull that, and that drum will go.
Ah.
And the whole thing will just rise up. And then eventually it'll end up right up over the truck. And the truck will start
Excellent.
To drive towards it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll just stop and back up and release the pins that hold the payload on the truck.
It's got to get exactly
underneath. They want it absolutely
underneath.
Perpendicularly under. And you can see with a little
mirror
up there, that's attached to the truck, so you know that it's in a really good line, so they're going to go straight ahead.
Okay.
The worst thing is if you get an extreme wind shift up there, and it would somewhere off over to an extreme angle on the side. That's what they've been trying to wait for, is the wind strength up through to that 1,000 feet altitude to get stable.
Right, she's still putting out the piebald.
Not till the very last minute, and I'll start doing them every 15 minutes now instead of every half hour, which they've been doing.
And if the balloon, it gets filled up, but it doesn't seem like a good idea, it's just pack it in and...
Once they put gas in the balloon, that's it. The balloon
it's
is
going.
Close. Well, not necessarily it's going. I mean, if the wind suddenly picked up and they had to let the gas, they could let the gas out by the valve.
Yeah.
But that's the end of that balloon.
Yeah, but they want to save the
payload.
They want to
save the payload at all costs, yeah. I mean, balloon's worth $150,000. So, you know, it doesn't take much to, you know, pop the gas and that's it. It's over.
Wow.
Down here are some of the really most interesting, the times when the wind drops and you have no reflectors around you at all,
you're out on the, especially in the West Antarctic, it's flat. And when you have no reflectors, you really get no sound coming back to you that you're generating. So it actually can get still enough that you hear your heartbeat. And that's pretty interesting.
Mm.
Especially when the wind is completely still.
Mm-hmm.
And then the wind, probably the other extreme would be when the wind is really screaming and you're in a tent and everything's just sort of vibrating. You get, you know, guys vibrating and poles humming and, you know, bamboo sometimes will, even a crack in the bamboo, the wind blowing past it, the whole thing will whistle. And, it's always, that's always interesting. You get the tent, we'll set up harmonics and the tent will vibrate and it gets pretty intense when the wind's really screaming. Wind in particular produces a lot of white noise at the surface. You can't really correlate it between phones. You can't subtract it out. And it can, if the wind starts blowing to where the snow is moving, we have to stop our work because it just hammers the geophones. They're so sensitive that it'll swamp the geophones. And even though these are very sensitive and we have a fairly large explosion, some of the reflections that are recording are very, very small. So just the noise of the snow moving across the surface will swamp those kinds of reflections. The wind...
You're listening to Giant Ear. I'm Andrea Poli. This is Sonic Antarctica. We just heard the sound of ozone balloon data at the South Pole this season, and the sound of the long duration balloon launch, a little bit of an excerpt of an interview with Don Voigt, who is setting up a series of passive seismic recorders all along the Transantarctic Mountains. And he was talking about some of his sound experiences, not only in Antarctica, but also in Greenland, where they were doing active seismic, where they're actually creating explosions in the ice. Earlier in this broadcast, you heard an excerpt from an interview with Rick Astor, and he was talking about how the natural world has analogs in the orchestra. And one of the things that Rick does as a seismologist is he takes seismology data and he shifts it in the sound frequency so it becomes audible. And so this next group of recordings are 2 minutes of seismic data that Rick Astor recorded on Mount Erebus in Antarctica, shifted to the audible frequency range.
But the atmospheres and fluids only support one type of wave, familiar sound waves, which are just compressions and expansions, you know, changes in pressure that propagate
right.
at a single velocity. Solid materials, like the solid parts of a volcano, actually propagate two types of fundamental waves. One is very much like the one in the atmosphere. It's a compression rarefaction. The other is called a shear wave, and that is actually a side-to-side motion that propagates more slowly than the faster compressional wave. You can sort of understand that intuitively by thinking about the kinds of elasticity that you have. If you've got a fluid, like water or air, it really has only one kind of elasticity. If you change its volume, it'll snap back, it'll
yeah.
push back. But it won't push back at all if you just change its shape.
Okay.
Solids have two types of elasticity. They have that sort of volume elasticity. They also have what's called a shear elasticity. And because of that, if you do the physics right, you can derive that there should be two types of seismic waves. And then it's me.
Uh-huh.
And modulations, the amplitude modulations of the signal. I think it gives me an understanding of the signal that I'm looking at the same time I can analyze it with Fourier or other techniques to understand it mathematically. So it leads to a richer understanding of the process that we're trying to study. Well, it's sort of been a mystery. People started picking these up originally here in Antarctica and as far away as Tahiti, believe it or not, because they get into a sound propagation channel in the ocean called the SOFAR channel that is a low-velocity zone in the ocean that can carry signals thousands of miles. Whales use it for communication. And so people started picking these signals up, and they didn't know what they were. We started picking them up on Mount Erebus, and originally we thought that it was a process called volcanic tremor, which has been seemed to occur on some volcanoes around the world.
Okay.
But eventually, we tracked it to these giant icebergs that started calving off of the Ross Ice Shelf around 2000, 2001.
Oh.
And as these icebergs grind against each other, they basically produce a sequence of tens of thousands of tiny ice quakes.
Huh.
And these ice quakes occur so regularly, about once a second, that when you take the Fourier analysis of a very regular, you know, spiky time series, it
So you've been listening to some recordings by Rick Astor of seismic signals, and then excerpts from an interview with him. And this last excerpt, he was talking about the sound of icebergs grinding. And there's the scientists were all really interested in this one sound recording that was done by a scientist named Dr. Doug McHale from University of Chicago. And it's the sound of iceberg B-15A. B-15A broke off and floated into McMurdo Sound. It was about the size of Rhode Island. And it ended up keeping the ice from breaking up. The ice would break up in McMurdo Sound every summer, and B-15 kept the ice from breaking up. And this large piece that broke off of the ice shelf, this is its sound. And a lot of people call this the cry of B-15.
You know, people don't know that that's actually how Rhode Island was formed.
Oh.
Yeah.
A giant iceberg.
Yeah, it was a giant iceberg, and then it floated up and attached itself. And actually, this is not, I'm not making this up. There is an episode of the Super Chicken cartoon that deals with this villain trying to steal Rhode Island. And they floated out into the ocean, and there's like a helicopter involved, but Super Chicken comes to the rescue and reattaches Rhode Island to the United States, which the United States would be very different without it. So
here is the cry of Super Chicken.
let me come back to, if I may, to the smoking gun.
Okay.
It's not a smoking gun, it's a smoking machine gun. So one bullet has already fired, and there are many more in the magazine which are ready to be fired as well. And unless we do something, we cannot avoid these bullets to come as well. And that's the issue. And that's my second point. A lot of people consider climate change as being sort of a monolithic thing to deal with. It's not the case. That's, for me, the second most important thing people should learn about and think about. And that is, we have a choice. The choice means we can still avoid a very large climate change. And a very large climate change is one where we risk to trigger runoff processes which will feed back on the climate and speed up the climate change in a way which is much more scary than what the more moderate projections indicate. And for those reasons, I believe it is very important that we see it's not the question.
That one paper, that one area on the Earth, was taken as evidence that all of the globe is not warming, so it was misused. And I think because of that, scientists are a little bit scared of, you know, there's a bit of spin going on from the other side as well, just to try and keep it from getting out of control. Because you can go out and you can find areas of the Earth that are right now, like Antarctica, and not warming, they're cooling. You know, you're not going to expect the whole planet to be red. That's it's the average. And so, you know, I'd be shot if I said this. You know, I don't want to go too far with this. But I think that it's important that both sides focus on the facts and just state what the data is, state what the interpretations are, and stop the spinning. You know what I mean? And when you do that, the story is that the globe is warming and that we are in trouble. I don't see how anyone can argue against that. And I don't see how it's become such a big political.
I think the most important thing is to keep in mind that we have very good solutions, that we can observe a high complexity in the high area, and to understand that many observations on the they might look controversial, but because of the complexity of the system, they actually, if you look closer to it, they actually fit together. So, I would say it's important to keep in mind for the public to filter out that news in the press releases and in that reports and newspapers. That's very important. And to keep the big picture in mind.
Most of them have no understanding of time. Most people's understanding of time is so pathetically thin and insignificant. Human life scales, like I think some things just drive you crazy. Like there'll be people talking about like a forest fire, for example. And they'll say, you know, we shouldn't let these forest fires burn because, you know, it takes, you know, 100 years for that, you know, it'll never come back.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just pathetically stupid. In the life of a forest fire is a second compared to your life. The point is that you may see that as devastation, and your grandchildren may see that as devastation, and their grandchildren may see that as devastation. But the trees would come back on their own time scale, not your time scale. So human beings, in general, have this horrible understanding of how old the Earth is, how slowly some processes work, which goes back to like why you shouldn't fuck it up. You know, we could completely screw the Earth up and it would come back. The problem is that it might not come back for a million years. Now to the Earth, a million years, who cares? It's nothing. But in human history, you fucked yourself.
Right.
Thank you.
you know, I don't get panicked about climate change because it does happen all the time. I get panicked about, like I said, the things we don't know. If we push the system so far in one direction, can we ever get it back? And what are the consequences? I think that the models can only tell us so much, and they don't tell us about these switches that can throw us off in one way or another in quite a dramatic fashion. So, that. But we get a lot closer to the truth with every step. So I think that's what we're doing right now with climate science, is there's more information coming up all the time. And some of the things that we don't know about, to me, are the scariest stuff, and that's like these switches in the system. For instance, the modeling is getting better and better all the time. That's the other point. Science to me is that we approach the truth. You know, we get closer and closer to the truth all the time. And we can never say we're 100% sure we're there. There's always going to be some little problem we come up with or whatever. But we get a lot closer all the time. So I think that's the big thing, is to have faith.
Science is the asking of questions.
Uh-huh.
That's the science. That's where the brilliance and intelligence of Finale comes in. Science is the asking of important questions, the questions that lead to. You know, I don't know the answer to those. I think about those questions all the time, and I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer. And I don't have the. I don't know. I have a scientific mind, and a scientific mind needs data, and I don't have the data. Thank you.
You're listening to Giant Ear. I'm Andrea Poli. This is Sonic Antarctica. The last two pieces you heard was a recording by Douglas McHale of Iceberg B-15A. That was a short piece, about a minute. And this last piece was a 20-minute piece by Dr. Robert Smalley and myself using seismic data, but in this case the seismic data was translated into smooth tones with the amplitude, the loudness of the tone changing based on the seismology. So this was more of a sonification as opposed to an audification of the seismic sound. Overlaid over the seismic sound, you were hearing excerpts from interviews with Dr. Adam Lewis, Dr. Peter Doran, Dr. Andreas Fischling, Don Voigt, and Dr. Wolfgang Rack, all scientists who've worked in Antarctica. Yes?
I have a question.
Okay, Johnny?
What is the difference between sonification and audification?
Oh, do we have a couple hours here? No, we don't.
No.
Okay. Never mind.
Yes,
I can. So audification is when you take the signal directly and you just shift it in the frequency band. So in the case of seismology, yeah, you've got vibrations there. They're vibrations, but they're too low for people to hear them. They're moving too slowly. So when you speed those up, that's an audification process. Or taking something that's too fast to hear and dropping it down. Sonification is making a lot more choices about what the data turns into in terms of sound. So in this case, Robert Smalley wrote a computer program that translated the seismic data.
I knew that. Because I don't know if the five people who are listening knew that, but they probably do if they're listening to this show.
Now they do.
That means they're hyper-intelligent.
Okay, this next piece. Right. This next piece is by James Travis. James Travis is a furnace technician down in Antarctica, and a DJ.
And a hot date.
I wouldn't know about that, Johnny. He's done a 7-minute piece, which is a sequence of sounds around McMurdo Station. So this is by James Travis.
Thank you.
You're listening to Giant Ear. I'm Andrea Poli.
This so is am I.
No, me.
No, it's me. I'm Andrea Poli. I'm just kidding.
And what are we listening to, Andrea?
I have no idea because I'm not the real Andrea Poli. You got me.
You're listening to Johnny Farrell on the mic. And that piece was by James Travis, a very important person down at McMurdo Station.
Hot date.
Furnace technician.
Yeah.
Ba-dum-tsh.
We're in the Nisei Igloo somewhere in Brooklyn. I won't say where, but it's a very cold spot. Or I should say cool spot.
Very cool.
Very cool.
And we've got about 5 minutes left of the show and no more sound material, so we were just going to chat a little bit.
Yeah, so Andrew, why don't you tell us, we were talking about this a little bit while the last piece was playing, but why don't you talk about sort of your feelings being on the ice, because that's something that is, not that many people in the world get to experience being there and having that feeling of being surrounded by this just complete field of white. And obviously you were there in a warmer time in the summer, etc. But what's it like? I mean, what were your feelings when you were like landing? You're just like, oh my God, what am I doing? Or seriously, take us through maybe, highs and lows of what it feels like to be a human in that part of the world where humans really shouldn't be or not prepared to live in those places.
Well, stepping off the plane, it was interesting that you mentioned that. That was probably is one of the more dramatic memories that I have you're just completely overwhelmed by the scale of it when you step off the plane. It's just so gigantic. And that is really, I found to be really exhilarating. I didn't find that to be frightening or anything. The thing that was strange to deal with, although also not negative at all, was the fact that it was light 24 hours a day, and that was really great. You know, you could walk, go for a hike at 2 a.m, and you had a beautiful, almost 4 p.m. kind of sunset that would just last for hours, and that was wonderful.
People did a lot of drinking there too, right?
A lot of people did a lot of drinking.
Not you, of course. You were completely sober the whole time.
And I don't know. I think, you know, maybe when you talk about kind of some of the negative things about it or things that you might not expect is that actually I think people who were living down there for 6 months at a time or whatever actually felt that there wasn't a lot of privacy. Right. When you're at on the base, it's difficult to get a chance to go out. If you're not a grantee, as I was, and you didn't have helicopter hours, you were kind of stuck there. And you had your roommate, and you had, you know, seeing the same people every day. And so I think that people were less sort of faced with what it's like to be alone than being faced with what it's like to be seeing kind of the same faces.
How would you compare that to like being like an undergrad in college, like sleepaway college?
That's the drinking.
That's the drinking. But it's also maybe the privacy too, right? Because you like mm-hmm. you have your roommate there, and like maybe you're getting your party on, you know, and you're like something's going on, and you want to come back to your room. And then forget it.
You got your geek roommate there. Geeking your gig. Yep.
Shoot. No. But in all seriousness, like, what was your, let's think about our friend, good friend Andrea Williams for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And sound memory.
Okay.
So we've listened to a lot of the sounds that you've recorded. Obviously, you have those as memories and you can relive them and listen to them. But what is your overall impression in your mind of the sort of overarching soundscape of Antarctica? Does it have to do with the sort of contractors there and the sounds that, of the buildings and the machines? Or was there an overwhelming sense of like the nature of the place that sort of gave you this a sound memory or feeling?
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. I mean, I think I got what I was looking for, which was, you know, when you're here in New York, you're kind of overwhelmed by the sound of the city. And there you really are overwhelmed by the sound of the landscape or really the sound of kind of nothing, you know, or the weather. You hear wind. And the most dramatic thing that I remember, kind of the interesting thing was that I was trying to record this, the keynote of the dry valleys. I thought, you know, there's no other sound. There's no hardly any animals there. The animals are microscopic, you know. So I'll be able to hear this keynote of this geography or record it. And I kind of could hear this almost like high-pitched kind of sound. And so I was recording. I tried several times actually recording it. And every time I'd go back to the camp site and listen to it, there was nothing there.
It's your body.
And I finally realized, yeah, that I actually learned later that it was my nervous system.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, I don't know what that.
Yeah, no, that's what it
was. Or I was going insane. I don't know.
Yeah, you're going insane.
It could also be low-level hearing loss.
Right, that's the other thing. It could be tinnitus.
Tinnitus, yeah. So what, you know, here in New York is just completely drowned out. The sound of your own body, you really can hear that.
But, you know, it's funny because I actually, where I grew up, and we have to go, like, in a hot second now, so I'll make this short. But I remember as a kid growing up, like, waiting for my school bus, and this was out in rural Kentucky, and I would sit. And there's no way that my ears could have been ringing at that young age. I was like 7 or whatever. And I just remember sitting and listening in the dead silence in like 5 a.m. because I had to get on the school bus at like a retarded early because I'd be really far away from the school. And so I would just sit and listen and wait in the darkness for the lights of the bus to come through the trees and like swing around or whatever and come to pick me up. And I would just hear this ringing in my head, and it was just my nervous system. It had to be.
Wow.
I mean, what else could it have been?
The other thing is the...
I don't know what else it could have been.
The distance. Like, you can hear things at such a distance, and it's really interesting how different the sound is when it's like you're listening to something really, really far away.
You can also hear tangential reverberations of things. Like, I remember when I lived in Vermont, we went halfway down this winding road, and if you... At night, you could hear a car, literally when it was 2 miles away, because of the terrain, there would be a place where you could hear the car engine, even though there was no way that you should have been able to hear it. It was just reverberation after reverberation after reverberation, and there was nothing getting in the way.
Yeah. Yeah, the reflections off the ice and the mountains and stuff. It's really amazing.
Great. Well, listen,
I guess we're done.
I guess we're done. And thank you so much for sharing all that wonderful recordings and your thoughts and memories of being there. It's such an incredible place. And we're happy that you got home safely. And that's great. And we're glad you're back to Rock New York with some recordings. All right, so we're going to go. And
thank you to New York Society for Acoustic Ecology.
Yes.
103.9.
To Edmund Mooney and his loaning to us of the Nice Igloo this evening.
My pleasure.
Yes, you're the man. And also...
Johnny Farrow for rocking the mixer.
Word. And big word to Freeman up here, our friends up there in the woods in New York, who are holding it down and making it all happen for us here. So... Thanks, everyone, for listening, and good night. And